Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Justin Nystrom, author of Creole Italian, Sicilian Immigrants and the Shaping of New Orleans Food Culture. Yummy! We'll also hear from Patty Friedman about her new short story collection, Where Do They All Come From? Justin Nystrom is an associate professor of history at Loyola University, where he also directs the Center for the Study of New Orleans. He's the author of New Orleans After the Civil War, Race, Politics, and a New Birth of Freedom. But today we're talking about his new book, Creole Italian, Sicilian Immigrants and the Shaping of New Orleans Food Culture. Justin, welcome to The Reading Life.
I'm honored to be here.
This book made me so hungry for everything, from eggplant to oysters to pasta. I hope tasting all this food was part of your research.
Well, you know, it was really hard, especially when I was writing the oyster chapter, because my wife was pregnant.
Oh.
And I would slip out and buy oysters, and she would sometimes resent that.
I wonder why.
Yeah.
I mean, now, it's deep scholarship, but it's written in such a lively, wonderful way. You really carry the reader along. And you conjure this bygone era, particularly in the French Quarter, where so much of Italian heritage has been erased. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about what we've lost in that way.
Yeah, one of the big goals of this book was to get us to think as a city more broadly about our history. And a
right.
big part of that is, of course, this Sicilian or Italian past. And the Italians were maybe just as much to blame for that as anyone else because they assimilated so fully. I mean, they carried forward their traditions, but they also carried on with their business and adopted Creole. I mean, the title
yes.
is meant in irony. And so they cook Creole food before they ever cooked Italian food for New Orleanians. And we've lost a lot of that. But I'm hoping that, you know, some of the early feedback I've gotten back from people is, oh, you know, I was driving around after reading your book and I was starting to see places in a new light. And that really made me happy because that was definitely a goal of this book.
Oh, absolutely. But it's sort of like one of those puzzles for a scholar, I'd imagine, where you pull one thread and it leads you to other places. So you start off with Sicilian lemons and then you move to oysters and then you move to ice. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, the irony is I started in the middle. And like any good story, you know, if I were going to do an piece about you, I would do deep genealogical research because I believe people are the sum of their past and mm-hmm. the people that have gone before them. I'm a historian, after all. And so I started with the corner groceries thinking that I would do something on that because it is one of the more visible manifestations of this culture. And I kept pulling deeper into the past and not thinking I was going to write about the early 19th century, but to me, the trail began in Sicily, in Palermo, in the Conca d'Oro, where the lemon groves in the early 19th century start to become very profitable.
You make a point of saying these are Sicilian immigrants, not mm-hmm. Italian immigrants. So talk a bit about that and those Sicilian lemons.
Yeah, certainly. Well, there are Italian immigrants. You know, some of the notable, of course, Alciatore family who found, they're from northern Italy. And of course, Italian is an elastic concept. I mean, there isn't an Italy as we know it until the third quarter of the 19th century. And so there are these different Italian cities states. And culturally, they're very, very different. Even today, there's quite a difference between going to northern Lake Como and Palermo. So there were small numbers of Italians coming to New Orleans because it was a port city. We attracted people from all over the globe.
Absolutely.
Everywhere from China to Serbia. So Sicilians start coming in large numbers to New Orleans, though, because of the lemon trade. And lemons as a global commodity really start to flourish in that time period. It's 1820, 1830. They're coming to New Orleans. They're coming to New York, Boston, Philadelphia, all at the same time. Yeah.
And pasta factories were important in this book as well.
Yes. Macaroni, as people called it 120 years ago. You know, Americans ate what they would call vermicelli noodles, but not in the way that we know that today. And it's really not until the turn of the 20th century that Italian-style pasta, American-Italian-style pasta, as we know it, becomes very popular and even patriotic to eat because of the food shortages around the First World War.
And you remind us that there was a time when Italian cuisine was like the hot new food trend.
Oh, it was definitely the it food.
Yeah.
You know, there's a story I recount in 1908 at the what becomes the St. Louis Hotel, or is the St. Louis Hotel. It's a group of mortgage bankers, homestead offices, and they have a banquet, and they have it catered by Messina's Restaurant, which is on Decatur Street in 1908, and nobody knows how to eat it. Of course, you know, when you buy a box of spaghetti today, it's, you know, maybe 12, at the most, 12 inches long. I think it's a little less than that even. But a strand of spaghetti in 1908 was probably 30 inches long. And the newspaper reporter at the time is getting great amusement out of the fact that nobody knows how to eat it.
And that was a challenge, of course. How do you eat a 30-inch long strand?
Well, and by the 20s, you know, and so this very short period of time in the early 20s, you have Tucci's, which starts out on Decatur Street right next to where Two Jacks is today. And by the early 20s, they moved to Bourbon Street, and you have, you know, the ladies' auxiliary of a club to starting to eat their luncheons there. And it goes, shows you how fast it becomes mainstream.
Now, one of the things that was fascinating to me to read was the coincidence of the rise of restaurant culture with the arrival of these immigrants, that they kind of went along together for a while. And that's a happy thing for culinary history.
Really, it is. I mean, they're like all historical process. I always, to my students, they if they're hearing this, they would laugh. I almost, history is a process. So you have this intersection in the 1830s of the emergence of the restaurant, the arrival of Sicilians at the same time, and immigrants today tend to be involved in the restaurant trade. It's a hard business. There's a lot of hustling that must occur. And so particularly the early migrants from the island of Ustica.
Yes.
Some of you remember Maria Compagno and her place that was on St. Charles Avenue. Maria is a late immigrant who came here in 1950, but she had for a century or and more before many people coming with this tiny, tiny island.
Yeah.
And New Orleans boasts more Ustazi than any other place, even Ustica. It's sort of like Poles in Chicago. And they get into the oyster business in a big way. And they start with oyster stands, then saloons. And then the saloons start getting dining rooms. And they cater. Catering, you know, we talk a little bit about. Catering really precedes restaurant. The carryout really comes before the restaurant, not the other way around, which makes sense when you think about cooking in the 19th century. Ultimately, we see the development in the 1850s where you have the oyster saloon and restaurant becoming very commonplace in New Orleans and a core part of our culinary history, particularly with restaurants.
Oh, I love the idea of the oyster saloon. It sounds glamorous. And,
well, you know. And oysters on the half shell and takeout. I mean, being able to call as late as the 1930s to call a bar and have a bucket of beer and a couple of dozen raw oysters biked over to your place sounds sounds like there should be an app for that.
I know. And look at what we have now. Now, the other thing that your book brings home so beautifully is the restaurants. You know, we love to talk about the lost restaurants of New Orleans, but you talk so much about how restaurant culture was often a family affair and that so many of these endeavors were family affairs and were kept alive by large Italian families.
Yeah, multi-generational efforts. You know, the Tranchina family is really interesting because they start in oyster saloons in the middle of the 19th century, where the Rum House is today on Magazine Street was their first restaurant in the 1870s, their first big restaurant. And then they moved further down Magazine and ultimately up out to West End. And we talk about lost restaurants, but just completely lost landscapes. We forget how important the lake was to New Orleans culture, musically, culinarily. Just, it was one of the first places to get electric lights.
I know. And so
the Tranchinas, you know, their last restaurants really are in business as late as the 1980s. Mm-hmm. So a century of time. When I would interview people, one of the questions would be, well, what's ahead? You know, and there'd be a long pause. Because I remember interviewing Sal and Maria Impastato at Napoleon House, and if they're hearing this, it's in the interview, and they both kind of looked at each other and said, you know, this is a hard business. And of course, we know that they ultimately put it in the capable hands of Ralph Brennan, but it's a challenge in the family business. It's one of the things that's always in the mind.
Mm-hmm. Now, what to get back to those corner grocery stores where you started all this, you have a wonderful description of busy day at Terra Nova's and how that is a very family-oriented grocery store. And then there's this beautifully, beautifully written description of a very personal transaction in New Orleans with a bygone grocery store run by Lucy Ventura Vanderhaar. And this lovely passage shows the kind of trust that customers had in their grocers and the kinds of information they shared with them. And I thought it was really lovely, and I wonder if you'd read it for us.
I would be happy to do so. This came from an interview that I conducted with Miss Lucy's son, and he told me of this story. The localized nature of this special grocery took many forms. Miss Lucy's delivery orders always included the old New Orleans tradition of lagniappe, a bouquet of parsley or perhaps some spring onions slipped into the package. Decorative fruit baskets were a popular item at holiday time. The grocery employed a man to shuck oysters for customers, and as Frank Vanderhaar noted, of course, oysters for Thanksgiving was a very, very big thing. Everybody had to have oyster dressing, and they would start shucking oysters almost a week ahead, full time. The store would also deliver call-in orders of oysters on the half shell. Becknell remembered skilled butchers who could prepare things like crown roast of lamb and other items that were out of the ordinary. I remember Miss Lucy carrying out a wonderful Melba sauce. At this time, this was an exotic item. In the 21st century, making grocery often entails an automobile ride to a modern supermarket that may be clean, friendly, and efficient, but lacks any sort of personal touch. But the individual service and attention to detail offered by Lucy Vanderhaar's store meant a lot to her customers. According to Frank Vanderhaar, Lila Schaffenberg, who built and subsequently owned the Pontchartrain Hotel during its heyday in the 1940s and 1950s, called Miss Lucy one afternoon and said, "I was going through some things that were left over from when my wife died. I have a slip from Vanderhaar's groceries, from an order that my wife called into you many, many years ago. Could you fill that order again for me? I want to remember my wife." And Lucy did. Such personal connections not only made Miss Lucy famous and beloved, but sustained corner groceries and tied them to the communities they served.
I love that story. It's so moving. I mean, and it shows those deep connections we make.
Grocery shopping was part of your life.
Yeah.
And the sort of interpersonal exchanges that were part of that.
I bet you knew you had something wonderful when you heard that story,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Well, your book is full of wonderful stories like that. It is such a pleasure. We've been talking with Justin Nystrom about his fascinating new book, Creole Italian, Sicilian Immigrants and the Shaping of New Orleans Food Culture. Justin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Patti Friedman is a New Orleans novelist known for her insightful writing about her hometown, which she rarely leaves, and for her wicked, wicked humor. She's the author of Eleanor Rushing, Secondhand Smoke, Too Jewish, and many others. Today we're talking about her new book of stories, Where Do They All Come From? Patti Friedman, welcome back to The Reading Life.
I'm so happy to see you, Susan.
Ah, now of course, Where Do They All Come From takes its title from the Beatles song, Eleanor Rigby. And I wonder if you'd read the first page of your book for us, which is a bit of fake news.
Yes, I hate to use the word fake news,
but that's what it is.
I conjured this up. Headline, Beatles prescience reflected in government action. Dateline London, International News Service. It took over half a century, but the British government has acted on a serious problem that the iconic Beatles put to music back in 1966. Quote, I know it was my cousin Eleanor they sang about in that song about all the lonely people, said George Rigby, 87. It took this long for the government to address the problem. Today, Prime Minister Theresa May appointed a Minister of Loneliness. Quote, I expect a lot of flowers for Cousin Eleanor at St. Peter's Church graveyard in Liverpool now that there's no more stigma attached to being lonely, said Rigby. I wish Father M. had lived to see this day.
Oh, Patty.
When I fake it, I fake it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Now that I think about it, looking back over your work, loneliness has been such a great subject for you.
Well, I never realized it until all of a sudden I had all these stories together and I looked at my characters, and in varying degrees, they're all by themselves. One of the funniest things I realized looking back once it was in a book was that most of my characters are women speaking in the first person, mm-hmm. and you can see, if you look carefully, that they're lonely. But I have three stories at the end, told in the third person, about men. And those are the saddest, loneliest men that you could even imagine. They live by themselves. They have quirky, pitiful experiences. And those are the most lonely people of all. And I think they're realistic, even though I'm writing from a male point of view and have never been one.
And then there's Basket. You do all this stuff with places like Walgreens and Winn-Dixie and stuff. You observe people shopping, you know? Just talk about that conceit, because I just adored it.
Well, I always like to say that all fiction is autobiographical. There's always a little thread of it in anything you write, anything anyone writes. And I looked at that story from, you know, the perspective of now, looking back on when I wrote it, and I thought, what's autobiographical in here? And then I remembered that my young son, who's now fully grown, once said, when we edged away from our basket in the grocery, "Mommy, somebody's going to steal our basket." And I thought, what a strange thought, because, hey, who cares if you steal it when I haven't paid for it? And that was where I got that idea. But I laid it onto a very strange man. That story seems like pure, pure fiction. But when you take a little boy's strange ideas, it turns out to be one of my most fun stories.
It leads you to some unexpected places. I mean, I'm always swapping baskets with people by accident in the grocery store, but I never have gone so far as to buy them and, you know, pay for the stuff and take it home. But I love the way he makes these incredible conjectures about the people, diagnoses their lives as a result of what they buy, which you really can do.
Yeah, well, he not only diagnoses their lives, he usurps them and lives them and takes the constraints of their limited lives. I mean, if he steals a basket that's full of, you know, fat-laden meat, yeah. He lives for a couple of weeks on the meat that that person chose for her life. And that's a very weird way of...
Troubling. Very troubling.
I like to trouble people.
Yes, you did. You did. Now, one of your favorite characters, all-time characters, Jerusha Bailey, is back in this collection.
Those short stories appeared as they were. I have two instances of that. These stories appeared intact first, and then I put them together in full-length novels.
Uh-huh.
And there are two stories in this collection about Jerusha, and then they appeared as pieces of a novel called Secondhand Smoke, which is my favorite book of all my work. Jerusha Bailey comes from personal experience. To go back to that terrible first husband, she was my first mother-in-law, and that was a mean old racist witch. And I knew when I wrote that novel, I hate to give it away, but she had to redeem herself. Now, my ex-mother-in-law, may she rest in peace, never did redeem herself, but you don't even see it in these two short stories, because they fall toward the beginning of the collection in the narrative. Jerusha is really a character.
So what is it like for you when you're putting together a book like this to go back and look at what you've written, what you have published or haven't published, and to look at these pieces of things that you've done for so long? Has it given you a new insight into your work? What is that feeling like?
Well, when I put together this collection, it was more of a emotional action on my part. I thought, oh, wow, these stories, for the most part, have appeared in obscure journals, and they haven't seen the light of day. I think I'm going to just pull out the file that says short stories and pull them out and say, oh, man, this punched people in the stomach. I think I'll put it in my collection. And I eventually did pull them together and put them in a book. And then people like the blurbers and the reviewers looked at them, and they saw all these threads in them. And I started getting all these insights about my little self. I never realized that there were commonalities among several of them. I mean, one of the biggest issues in my life, and I didn't realize it, was that I'm obsessed with the concept of place and home. And so many of these stories, most of these stories date way back. You know, my life, surprise, surprise, a delineation point is August the 29th, 2005.
Right.
Pre and post Katrina, and I didn't evacuate, and I'm crazy from Katrina and all this kind of stuff. But I have such a strong focus on home, and these places in the stories surprise me at how much they have in common. I mean, there are two stories, a Jerusha story, and then another story called Liana. That story took place in a house several blocks away from Secondhand Smoke. It's on Valence Street.
Yes.
And Jerusha lives right across the street from the Valence Street Cemetery. And
Valence, as you once did.
Yes. And Valence Street is one of those New Orleans streets where you can go about four blocks and the value of a house will go from $200,000 to $1.5 million. And there I am on Valence Street, sense of home, sense of place. And so many of these, and of course, especially these stories about the men who stay locked up in their little, sitting in their little recliners, feeling safe in their little spaces. I never realized until people started reading the collection that I have a particular focus on such strong issues. Another issue is that I didn't realize, and I don't know why I have this thing, is that I write about twins a lot.
You do. I noticed that again, thinking about that in this book.
And I think it goes back to when my daughter was in sixth grade, she wrote a poem, and one of the lines was, "Symmetry offends the gods."
Yes.
So I have these twins who are identical, and yet they're not. And so I'm dealing with, hey, I'm going to break the symmetry. So I learned all kinds of stuff about myself by looking at this collection and saying, hey, you know, it's not just pulling the stuff out of the short story file in the cabinet. It's you've got things in your head that tie together coherently. And who would have ever guessed?
I like to think I would have eventually.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well,
steady reading of these things.
Yeah, but that's Susan Larson.
Oh,
no,
please, please. But I loved revisiting the stories that I knew already. It was fun to read them, but it was so much fun to read the new ones. It was just amazing. I love those two, Basket and Not Much Good at Company. From the very title, I just went, oh, okay. But I noticed you have, besides the twins, besides the loneliness, you have all these people who are in some way struggling to connect and break free and do the right thing. Even Jerusha, you know, on her journey with her husband's ashes, you know, which she loses, we should say, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's that her loss of her husband's ashes somewhere outside of Atlanta.
I know.
Is probably my finest comical moment.
That was one of the toughest road trips ever, I think, in fiction. And also, you have lots of chocolate in this collection, but not very sweet. It's not
I
very
do?
Sweet. You
oh,
do.
Oh, good. I have to write that one down. I
All
didn't
right.
realize.
Go looking for the chocolate, which I enjoyed a lot. We've been talking with Patty Friedman, whose new story collection is Where Do They All Come From? You can meet her along with novelists Brian Camp and Kent Wascom when they discuss their latest books Thursday, September 27th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Patty, thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Keith O'Brien discusses and signs Fly Girls, how five daring women defied all odds and made aviation history. Monday, September 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Registration for the Bayou Writing Workshop that begins on September 18th is still open. This 8-week creative writing workshop offers small group manuscript review and in-class writing prompts. For more information, contact Constance Adler at bayouwritingworkshop.com. Gabriela Aleman signs and discusses her novel Poso Wells with Yuri Herrera, Tuesday, September 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Also coming up, Happy Birthday, Mr. Faulkner, which takes place September 22nd through 25th, sponsored by the Pirate's Alley Faulkner Society. The theme this year is Place as a Muse for Literature. Walter Isaacson will open the event with a talk Saturday at the Cabildo. Sunday will feature advice sessions and manuscript critiques until 2 p.m. Sunday evening, John Biganay hosts Everything's Coming Up Roses, featuring a discussion of Faulkner's A Rose for Emily and the symbolism of roses through the ages, followed by a stage reading. Monday, September 24th, there will be literary discussions at the New Orleans Jazz Museum starting at 9:30. Then Tuesday from 10 to 1, there will be literary discussions at the Presbyter, featuring this year's competition judges: Lady Hubbard, Zachary Lazar, Moira Crone, John Biganay, Emma Walsh, Roger Kamenetz, Peter Cooley, and Laura Lane McNeil. They will appear with winners in their categories. For detailed info and tickets, go to FaulknerSociety.org. Three local authors, Brian Camp, author of The City of Lost Fortunes, Patty Friedman, author of Where Do They All Come From, and Kent Wascom, author of The New Inheritors, discuss their work Thursday, September 27th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Fall 2018 New Orleans Writers Workshop has new classes starting in October. This is an adult creative writing program taught by local authors. It offers courses at locations around the city, including NOCA, the Dragonfly on St. Claude, and the New Orleans Museum of Art. All skill levels welcome. Visit neworleanswriters.com to register. L'Union Française is offering a new series of mini-courses designed to welcome intermediate, advanced, and even fluent speakers of French into a literary conversation with some language instruction. The works by such authors as Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, Jean-Paul Sartre, Luis Aragon, and Eugène Ionesco ask important questions about what it means to be free, to have a just society, why our lives matter. This is a teach-in of the very rich literature that was inspired by the French Resistance. Each class has three meetings, 2 hours each, and discusses a short work or a series of short works. The first session runs through September 22nd and covers Rhinoceros by Eugène Ionesco. Poetry of the French Resistance begins September 29th. Check out the website lunionfrancaise.org for complete details. The Diana Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction will be presented Saturday, October 6th at 6 at the George and Joyce Wien Jazz and Heritage Center, 1225 North Rampart. The winners this year are Ellen Hart, whose most recent book is A Whisper of Bones, who's receiving the prize for Distinguished Body of Work for her long-running Jane Lawless and Sophie Greenway series. The winner of the debut novel prize is Marcy Rendon, author of Murder on the Red River. The public is welcome. And a big congratulations to the winner of the Louisiana Writer Award this year, poet and essayist Cheryl St. Germain. She will receive her award at the Louisiana Book Festival in Baton Rouge, November 10th. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.